I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Before we start today's episode, I want to let you know about two quick things. Unmistakable Creative t-shirts, designed by our special projects artist, are now available for sale. And we have both men's and women's, and they're available in red, gray, and pink. And they look really cool. So visit unmistakableart.com and pick one up today. Our sponsor for today's episode is Thrasher Coffee. If you need some coffee to fuel your creativity, be sure to check out Thrasher. Their coffee is delicious and has been the rocket fuel for our team here at Unmistakable Creative. Even by coffee snob standards, it's a steal for only $18.99 for a one-pound bag. And if you sign up for a subscription, you'll even get a free French press. Visit ThrasherCoffee.com and get a 50% discount when you use the promo code CREATIVE. Now, let's get into today's episode. In this episode of The Unmistakable Creative, I speak with Chris Bailey about his year of productivity in which he conducted experiments like watching 70 hours of TED Talks, using a smartphone for only an hour a day for 3 months, living in total reclusion for 10 days, and what he found to be essential to managing your time, energy, and attention. Chris, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, my pleasure. So I actually came across your story by way of one of our listeners. And when I went and looked up everything that you were up to, I was very intrigued because I wondered how a human being could be so productive and pack so many things into so many small segments of time. And I wanted to really get to know you and talk to you about this. So on that note, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your story, your journey, your background, and how it's led to everything that you're up to now?
Oh man, how long do you have? That's like a whole book in and of itself. But I guess I'll start from about 10 years ago.
Okay.
I picked up a book named Getting Things Done. It's by an author named David Allen. He's like the productivity guy. If there's one name that people associate with traditional kind of productivity, I think it's this David Allen guy. And I was in Chapters, which is kind of the equivalent of the Barnes & Noble. It's the Canadian Barnes & Noble. Have you heard of Chapters?
Yeah, I have actually.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And I picked up that book, you know, just for the hell of it. I got a bit curious. Then I kind of pored over it. And that was kind of the tipping point that got me interested in this whole idea of productivity, you know, accomplishing more in the same amount of time. So you have more time for the things that are meaningful to you. That was about a decade. It's kind of weird looking back. A decade, I guess, isn't a whole lot of maybe it is a lot of time in the grand scheme of things, but that's beside the point. You know, fast forward 10 years, I graduated university in May of 2013. I'd been investing in my productivity up to that point. I'd read, you know, hundreds of books and all this sort of stuff, of following all the blogs and everything like that. And the day I graduated, you know, I'd worked hard up to that point. I had a few good internships throughout university. And the day I walked out the door, I had a couple full-time job offers that were offered to me from these big companies, a couple of which I'd done internships with. And I was trying to kind of decide between them, but I kind of came to the realization that no of those two jobs would really give my life that much meaning. You know, I could see the next 40 or 50 years ahead of me, kind of, you know, in the movies where they look down the hallway and it kind of stretches off into the distance and they have that effect where it doubles the length of the hall. That's like what my life looked ahead of me. I could see the career progression, the salary increases, the promotions, the retirement, the green lawn, the wife, the kids, the everything. And I didn't freak out, but I just thought, like, this totally isn't for me. And then I thought, you know, what is kind of meaningful and aligned to what I actually care about? And I came to the realization that it was productivity. You know, it's kind of weird in a way. Most normal people are into things like music and sports and things like that. But for some reason, I got bit by that bug about a decade ago. And so I decided to decline those jobs to start a project named A Year of Productivity. Should I keep going?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Am I rambling?
No, not at all. Good? Keep going.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so I started a project named A Year of Productivity. I essentially looked at how much money I had in the bank account. I had about $20,000 as student loans when I graduated, which wasn't actually all that bad because I had those paid co-op internships. But because I had those internships, I also saved up 12 grand when I graduated. And I figured, you know, if I live really, really, really frugally for a year, if I ate a lot of beans, a lot of rice, lived very cheaply, I could make it through a year, you know, spending $1,000 a month times 12, it's $12,000. That's how much money I had in the bank. And I thought, you know, I couldn't explore this idea of productivity forever, but I could dedicate a year of my life to it. You know, these projects, you know, it felt kind of a bit cliche to do a year-long project, but that was, you know, how much financial runway I had. And so a couple Mays ago, I declined those two full-time job offers to start a year of productivity. It was a blog at the time. And, you know, so for a full year, I interviewed my favorite experts in the field, people like David Allen. I had the chance to speak with him a few times. People like, probably a lot of the folks you've had on your show, like, you know, Charles Duhigg, he wrote a book named The Power of Habit. Mm-hmm. You know, all those kinds of people, I won't name drop any further, I promise, that I got a chance to interview. And I dove into hundreds of journal articles and books over that time too. And also kind of the weirder part of the project was I conducted these productivity experiments on myself where I used myself as a guinea pig to explore this idea of productivity. So I meditated for 35 hours over the course of 6 days. I was actually just meditating before we talked. So if I sound, you know, pretty chill right now, I feel good. I watched 70 hours of TED Talks over a week to play around with things like information retention and taking breaks, how that impacted how I retained the information and focused. I did things like I used my smartphone for only an hour a day for 3 months. I worked 90 hours a week for a month, alternating between working 90 hours 1 week, then 20 the next, then 90, then 20. I drank water for a month. You know, I lived in total isolation for 10 days. You know, I did dozens of these experiments to basically throw a bunch of ideas at the wall that related to productivity and see what stuck. And then I wrote about everything that I learned.
Hmm. Whew. Okay, so lots of questions about this.
Lots to unpack, I guess, yeah, with that.
So one of the things that I always want to do is go back and look at sort of the formative experiences prior to the start of a journey that would even lead you down such a weird path. You know, when you're growing up, childhood, you know, people in your life. I mean, what in the world would lead to this?
I think curiosity, to be honest. You know, I've always been a curious person. I've just been more inward facing than outward facing. You know, as one of those people who, I didn't have a ton of friends growing up. You know, we moved across, Canada's a big country, you know, to go from one end to the other. We lived in a province called Alberta. Have you heard of Alberta?
Yeah.
And Ontario? I was born in Red Deer. It's like 2 hours away, dude. Yeah. That's awesome. Where are you living now?
In Southern California, which is much nicer.
Okay. So a little bit different than that Edmonton, that's for sure. So I was born, yeah, a couple hours drive from where you lived, in Red Deer, or Dead Rear, as they call it in Red Deer these days. And in grade six, you know, things got kind of uprooted for me. We moved across the country to a city called Belleville, which I think is actually the teen pregnancy capital of Ontario, which is a badge of honor for the town of Belleville. I got out of there as quickly as I could. I live in Ottawa now, where I went to university, or college, as you say, in Southern California. And that kind of uprooting, you know, I'm kind of dancing around the point because I resist talking about it. You know, that uprooting kind of shook things up for me. You know, I spent a lot of time around people, but when you go from, you know, 100 to zero, mm-hmm, with the amount of people that you're surrounded with all the time, and it's not like I was put into a school in Ontario in a natural transition phase. You know, this was in the middle of grade six. I had to adapt. I had to make new friends. And, you know, I'm an introvert. I'm a shyer guy. just by default. And so I had a hard time doing that. So that kind of made me look inwards more and kind of look around for ideas to get curious about. That was grade six. You know, I wasn't too curious about productivity back then. I probably had no idea what it is. You know, even if I talk to my grandma about what productivity is, she has no idea what the hell I do right now, even though I just wrote a book. Mm-hmm. But you know, those are kind of the formative years where I began kind of looking inwards to look around for what dots I wanted to connect going forward, to kind of surround myself with a ton of different ideas and kind of swim in that pool for a little bit. And I kind of took that attitude throughout university and through today, I think.
Mm. You know, one of the things that you said that really intrigues me is that you could sort of see what the future looked like before you if you were to choose one of these jobs that you had you received offers for. And yeah. I think that's unusual at such a young age. And I'm interested in, one, how we start to do that in our lives. And also, you know, you mentioned this idea of finding the things in your life that give you meaning. How do you do that? Yeah.
Oh man, that's so difficult. I think you have to start with what you value. You know, think deeply about what you care about. That's I think step zero to anything. You know, if everything you do over the course of the day is aligned to what you value. You know, I value efficiency. I value science. I value, you know, these kinds of ideas that productivity is connected to, which is why the project was so meaningful to me, I think. Mm-hmm. I haven't unpacked that idea too much because I've been unpacking so many of the ideas that surround productivity itself. But I think that's kind of a curious one to look at. Another kind of cool example, I think, is, you know, maybe a California example for you is when the University of California at Irvine was first built. The school was built without any sidewalks. And a few of the schools around North America did this at the time. I think it was around the 50s or the 60s. And what they did is they basically erected a bunch of buildings that made up the campus, and the students and faculty walked around in the grass around those buildings. And what they did is the urban planners that designed the university, they looked at the paths that people had carved out in the grass, and that's where they laid the sidewalks on top of. And that was kind of a similar analogy that I took with me to start the project is, you know, not only what do I care about, but what have I done in the past? You know, looking back throughout the last 10 years of my life or since I can remember, you know, when have I been the most motivated? You know, I have all these data points kind of looking behind me. When have I been the most motivated? When have I been the most inspired? When have I been the most driven? And when have I felt the most meaning and passion for what I was doing? And all of those concepts orbited around the idea of productivity. And I think, you know, to the other question, kind of seeing ahead, you know, there's a Steve Jobs quote I love that where he says, you can only connect the dots looking backwards. You can't connect the dots looking forwards. And so something like that is pretty much impossible. Nobody has the foresight to see exactly what it would be like. But I think it was the internships that kind of gave me that perspective. I could see in the colleagues, I had internships in the government during business school. I had internships in the private sector for big companies, small companies, every company in the middle. I could see, you know, people from all walks of life in all different departments of the company. You know, I worked in HR, so I could see, you know, how much money did these people make? And I could talk to them and figure out, okay, how much debt do these people have? And like, why don't they care about what they're doing? Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're in HR, you can kind of, you kind of step back and you can see the entire organization. One of those terms I worked, it was for an entire year. So I could see managers throughout the organization progress upwards, and engineers turn into managers, and managers turn into directors, and directors turn into vice presidents. And I could see, you know, what separated the high performers from the low performers. And I kind of took a step back and thought, you know, that's, you know, it's not for me. Maybe it will be someday, mm-hmm. but right now, like I just don't care about that. So that's when I turned to productivity.
Mm. You know, I think it's interesting. I was just working on a piece and what likely might end up being a section of my book called The Seductive Bargain of Society's Life Plan. And to me, that's largely what you're describing, is what appears to be something really good,
but may not be. And I think the bigger thing that, you know, I take away from what you just said is this idea of the work being meaningful to you. It's really easy, yeah. I think, when we look at successful projects on the internet or, you know, other ways of being successful, thinking that we want those things, but not considering that they may not be meaningful to us. In fact, I have found that if the work is meaningful to you, you are much more likely not only to follow through with it, but to be successful with it.
Oh, for sure. And I found that with the experiments in my project too. One of the ones I tried to conduct, or I did conduct, was waking up at 5:30 every morning. Mm. And, you know, the ritual that I created around that, you know, it was the stuff productivity dreams are made out of. You know, I woke up at 5:30 and I prepared and I drank a coffee. At 6, I walked to the gym. I planned out my entire day when I was working out from 7:15 to 8:15. I made a huge breakfast and showered and meditated. At 8:15, you know, I was disconnected from the internet throughout this whole time, so I could kind of rise above my work and plan it. You know, I reconnected from 8:15 to 9. I read, and from 9 onwards, I began working. But then I kind of, you know, I fell in love with the idea of this ritual instead of actually falling in love with the ritual itself. And when I took a step back from it, you know, the idea of that ritual, it's the sexiest productivity idea out mm-hmm. there, you know, being the person who's ultra productive and does yoga and works out in the morning. But in practice, I freaking hated it. And it's like a bad breakup, right? Where you spend some time away from somebody and you suddenly fall in love with the idea of that person instead of, you know, how much you actually hated being with them. You know, productivity, life, breakups, they're all the same. You know, they're in my opinion, you know, there's the idea of what something is like, and then there's what that thing is actually like. Like, New Year's resolutions are the exact same way. Over 90% of people fail at the resolutions they make. And, you know, it's not only because things aren't aligned with what they value. You know, people try to work out for an hour every day and when they actually don't care about working out. But it's because the idea of making a change to your life, and this is the hard part about productivity, is so much sexier than what you actually have to do to achieve that change, to actually make it from, you know, do that transition uh-huh. from something being an idea to something being a habit. That's where the sausage is made with regard to productivity. And that's the part that people forget about, I think. They focus on the idea and not so much what they actually have to do to make it happen.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like writing a book, right? You get to see the end result of it, but what you don't see is that it's every day just a grind of sitting in front of a computer typing.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I just finished my book last week. I think I handed it in. You know, the reason I don't know is because life has been a blur for the last 6 or 7 months, but. You know, people around me are patting me on the back and saying, like, dude, you wrote a freaking book. Like, that's incredible. But from my point of view, from kind of the inside looking out, it's the opposite. It's like I've had to grind at cranking out a ton of words every single day, and it's been worth it. It's been worth the extra effort that I put into it to make the book not good, but, you know, that's something that I'm proud of. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's totally different, I think, from the idea that people have about it.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears a little bit and let's start talking specifically about your experiments that you conducted in a bit more depth. Yeah. And what I'd like to do is do a deep dive into the ones that you mentioned, you know, the 70 hours of TED Talks, the living in isolation, and talk about what personal takeaways were from each one and how they could be applied to our own lives.
Cool. Where do you want to start?
Let's start with the TED Talks.
There's so many of them.
Let's start with the TED Talks because that one intrigues me. I want to talk a bit about information and retention, given that, you know, people listen to our podcast very much the same way people consume TED Talks.
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. That was kind of a weird one in that I didn't really learn too much about information retention. Mm-hmm. You know, I kind of approached each of these with an open mind for what I had learned with it. And you know, the big thing I learned from that was the power of curiosity and creativity with regard to productivity. Like, the most productive people, they work smarter instead of just harder. And to work smarter, I think you have to bring this kind of creativity to what you do. And something that I found recently is that, you know, the productive people are the ones who basically connect the most dots. And, you know, to make Uber for an example, you know, you have to understand a lot about the taxi industry, and you have to understand a lot about the app industry. And it's by connecting those two ideas that you create a $50 billion company. You know, acquiring these dots, you know, in terms of knowledge and experience and conversations like the one we're having and podcasts that you listen to and perspectives and reading books and understanding history to see how, you know, humanity connected the dots to make the world today. You know, learning from your mistakes and making mistakes and doing experiments like the ones maybe not as crazy as the ones I did in my project, but these are all ways of connecting dots. And creativity, I think, is the process of connecting dots. And the more dots you connect, I think the more productive you can become. I define productivity as achieving what you intend to accomplish. Mm-hmm. And so it's about that kind of intention behind what you do. I think that bit is crucial. And, you know, in terms of connecting the dots, you know, just being immersed in the 70 hours of TED Talks, a lot of folks ask me when we chat about that experiment, you know, what TED Talks stood out for me. And really, there are only a few ones that did. And what they all had in common was that the people that gave them were the ones who were so open to this idea and just immersed themselves in so much information that they connected a bunch of dots to get to where they were on the TED stage. So that was probably the biggest lesson that I learned from that experiment. It was a fun one. Mm-hmm. It was definitely one of the funner ones. Like, there was one I did living in total isolation for 10 days, which was just, you know, a drag to get through the entire thing. But the TED Talk one was one of the funner ones from the project.
Well, we'll talk about the isolation one. I want to actually talk a little bit more about the TED one. What I'm actually interested in is not what stood out for you, but how you actually designed the experiment and how we might go about designing similar experiments in our own lives.
Yeah, what I did is, you know, I basically started with the intention and I scheduled out each day. I blocked out, it's kind of hard to remember because I did it about a year ago, but I'll do my best. You know, I blocked off the time each day when I planned what talks to watch. I had some on my phone that I downloaded, some on my computer that I watched. I had a notepad next to my computer to jot down, you know, the interesting kind of nuggets from the talks, as well as the thoughts I had about productivity itself, as well as things to research and get curious about from the experiment. But I basically put out a call to my readers and asked, you know, okay, what TED Talks are your favorite? And I think I got about a couple days worth from that. And the rest, I went kind of through the categories on TED.com to dive deep into the topics that I cared about. But the way I designed the experiments is, you know, the reason a lot of them are crazy is because I started with what I wanted to measure and worked my way backwards to what experiment would be kind of the craziest way to measure that. So for the TED experiment, it was the information retention. It was how powerful taking breaks was. That was actually insanely powerful. You know, that's another thing I kind of came to realize over the course of the project is productivity. You know, the more you slow down and the more you take your time with things, the more deliberately you can work and the more productive you can become, I think. And so that's kind of how I designed them. You know, what did I want to measure? Then I worked backwards to an experiment from there. Hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes absolute sense. Okay, cool. So what in the world would you want to measure by spending all that time in isolation?
I wanted to measure two things. One was kind of big, one was minor. The big thing was, how do people impact my productivity? And where do people fit into this idea of productivity? And the other was actually sunlight. There was no sunlight in the basement in my house at the time. And so that was just something I measured as kind of a spandrel of the experiment.
So what sort of insights and takeaways did you have from that? I can't imagine that wouldn't lead you to a place of like a lot of depression.
Oh man, yeah. Because when you sunlight regulates your melatonin production in your body, and so your body doesn't know when it's day, it doesn't know when it's night. It was musty in the basement, so I was stuffed up for most of it. My immune system was shot because my body had no idea what direction was up. I let myself escape from the basement for just a few minutes when I needed to get food and you know when nobody was home, and it was kind of this beautiful idea of taking a step back from the people in your, you know, like when you take some time off around New Year's and you begin to step back from your work and you begin to kind of see the place that work fits into the bigger picture of your life, you begin to rise up above everything.
Mm-hmm.
This experiment was kind of similar in a way where I rose up above the people and the relationships and the friendships and just the people that I was surrounded with most of the time to see the place they fit into my life. And it was kind of an eye-opening experiment for me because I'm one of these people, I can take people for granted sometimes, and that's hard to admit, but it's true, and that's a reality I had to face during that experiment. You know, I kind of ignored some relationships in my life. I hadn't called my mom or dad in a while before doing that experiment, and when I took a step back from those relationships, you know, I kind of had these realizations that, like, holy shit, like, I'm really messing up with a lot of these things. And the reason for productivity in the first place is people. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no other better reason. You know, why would you do productivity for yourself? You know, you ask people why they want to become more productive, and most people say, you know, because of my family, because I want to leave a future for them. I want to leave a future for, you know, whoever comes after me. And so that was kind of the big lesson that I learned from that one. Also, the power of meditation. I love. Do you meditate?
Occasionally. I mean, I'm an avid surfer, so that's my form of meditation.
That's where you get into the flow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I realized just how sane meditation kept me during this experiment. I've had a daily meditation ritual for, I think, 5 or 6 years right now, where I meditate for 30 minutes over the course of the day, sometimes broken down into 15-minute chunks, sometimes all at once, you know, depending on how I'm feeling that day, whatever I'm comfortable with. And that really kept me sane because the thing that meditation does, and it doesn't have to be this, like, really spiritual practice. A lot of the business leaders that I deal with meditate frequently, but it didn't change what I was experiencing in the basement, but it changed how I related to what I was experiencing in the basement. And that's why I meditate every day, because no matter what happens with your work or with your life, when everything hits the fan, you know, meditation won't change that everything hit the fan, but it'll change how you relate to what happened, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that makes all the sense in the world.
There's more of my conversation with Chris after this short message from our sponsors. Have you checked out our friends at Thrasher Coffee? Well, they're offering a killer deal on their gourmet coffee, which is a steal, even by coffee snob standards. It's $18.99 for a 1-pound bag, and for Unmistakable Creative listeners, they're offering a 50% off discount. But you're not just buying coffee when you support them. You're supporting another small business owner and Unmistakable Creative listener. So visit thrashercoffee.com, use the promo code creative, get 50% off, and pick up a bag. The other sponsor for today's episode is Plowshares Solos, a reading subscription that delivers long-form stories and essays right to your e-reader. Longer than a typical short story, but shorter than a novel, Plowshares Solos are the perfect length to enjoy while drinking your morning coffee, on your commute, or relaxing after work. Buy a Plowshares Solo subscription now to make picking out your next read easy. Every month, you'll get a new story or essay delivered automatically to your Kindle, Nook, or smartphone for just $10. Visit pshares.org/creative to buy a year's worth of reading now. How do you know these stories are going to be worth your time? Plowshares is a world-renowned literary journal that has been publishing award-winning literature since 1971. Work first published in Plowshares is selected continuously for annual prize anthologies such as the Best American Poetry, the Best American Short Stories, the O. Henry Awards, and the Pushcart Prize. These stories are coming from one of the most prominent publishers out there, so you can trust they're going to be great. Subscribe today and get a year's worth of stories for $10 a year. Visit pshares.org/creative. Now, back to my conversation with Chris.
Well, let me ask you this. How would you say that you have connected the dots between all of these things to create a framework effectively, which is what I'd imagine the result was with your book, that can then be applied to our own lives to do what we wanted to do, really optimize our own productivity?
frameworks are hard, right? Because the human brain is meant, it's designed to categorize things. That's why we like that's why we like sporting teams. That's why we like putting labels on things. Like when you learn that somebody's an atheist, or when I tell somebody that I'm a Buddhist, uh-huh. you get this kind of jumbled up web of associations that comes along with that categorization. And so I usually try to fight against the categorization of things and labeling things. But that said, towards the end of the project, I realized something kind of huge with regard to productivity. And it was that every single thing I either experimented with or read about or whatever fit into one of three things. It fit either into managing your time, mm-hmm. Managing your energy, or managing your attention. And productivity, I think, is the confluence of these three things. If you can't manage your time properly, you'll end up spending half the day watching Netflix. Mm-hmm. If you can't manage your energy properly, you'll burn out at 1 p.m. and not have enough fuel in the tank to get through the day. If you can't focus, you're going to be multitasking and spreading your energy around in a million directions. Or, you won't be able to shine that attentional spotlight that you move around the world throughout the course of the day in one direction to get things done more efficiently. Productivity is time, energy, and attention. And where the three things meet in the middle, that's how productive you are. And that's kind of the framework that, once I realized that, I kind of look at things from a scientific kind of businessy point of view, even mm-hmm. though some of the experiments are crazy. I looked at what would make this model broken? So what are the exceptions to this model? And I couldn't really find anything with regard to human performance, nothing kind of that I found. And if somebody listening can think of something, that'd be awesome, because it would, it would just be another dot to connect things to. But I realized that nothing kind of fits outside the boundaries of time, energy, and attention as it relates to productivity. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the thing that everything fit into.
Okay, so let's actually do a deeper dive into those three things. How do you more effectively manage time? How do you more effectively manage energy? How do you more effectively manage attention? And talk to us about your own discoveries through the lens of your own story.
Yeah, sure. It's kind of a huge question to answer, because under each of these umbrellas, under time, energy, and attention, it's not that that's where the model begins to get more complicated, mm-hmm. way more complicated, because you can categorize things on this kind of high level. But underneath time, underneath energy, underneath attention, are hundreds of things that you can do to cultivate each. There isn't like a 10-step, unfortunately, there isn't a 10-step plan. These are the 10 things you have to do to accomplish everything you intend to, trademark. But that said, there are some things that help more than other things. Starting with time, maybe. One of the experiments I conducted was working 90 hours a week. So for a month, my project was first and foremost a research project. And so for a month, I did 90 hours of intensive research and interviews and writing 1 week, then 20 hours the next, then 90, then 20 for a month, to see how throwing more time at everything that I had to get done impacted how much I accomplished. Again, productivity isn't about how much you produce. It's about how much you accomplish. And something I realized when I took a step back from that experiment was that, and it might sound kind of hard to believe, and it was hard for me to believe at the time, but even though I was busier during the 90-hour weeks, when I took that step back and looked at how much I actually achieved during those 90 hours, I achieved about the same working 90 hours 1 week mm-hmm. and 20 hours the next. And the difference was how I spent my time. There are certain tasks in your work, and this is one of those painfully obvious lessons that you learn only in hindsight, looking backwards at things. But there are certain tasks in your work through which you accomplish more for every minute you spend on those tasks relative to everything else. And so take watching Netflix again versus working, editing a podcast. Uh-huh. For every minute you spend editing a podcast, you accomplish more and you impact so many more people, and you do things that actually have meaning to you versus watching, What's the Orange is the New Black? That's what just came out. Do you watch that show?
Yeah.
I've never seen it.
It's entertaining.
Is it good?
Yeah, it's very good. Yeah.
Would you recommend it?
Yes, absolutely.
Like, how many stars out of 10 would you give
it? It deserves 9 or 10. It's well written. It's entertaining. It's good.
Well, one of the experiments I'm planning for July, I haven't announced this yet, is watching Netflix for a month. So alternating between watching Netflix all day as like a full-time job one day and then working as much as possible the next. So trying to achieve as much as I possibly can the next day.
And I can't wait to hear how that turns out.
Seeing how my motivation is like impacted throughout that experiment. But back to the main thread, because... Mm-hmm. Go off on tangents. This is why I meditate, so I don't talk like this. there are certain tasks in your work through which you accomplish more than any other task. Mm-hmm. And that's something I realized working 90 hours a week. You know, just because you're busy doesn't mean you're productive. You know, that busyness makes you feel productive because your brain is more stimulated. It's more engaged. It's basically like an insane amount of activity that it's surrounded by. And so you get the illusion of productivity. But when you step back and look at how much you accomplish, you didn't actually do that much more. Uh-huh. And so I think that's where time management has to start, you know, is by taking that step back periodically throughout the day by working slower and more mindfully. But in general, you know, taking out a sheet of paper, and this is something that I recommend everybody on the planet do, is take out a sheet of paper and a pen and write down everything in your job or in your personal life. You can, you know, flip the side over for that you're responsible for, and, you know, get that all out of your head. And then ask yourself, if I can only do one thing on this list all day long, day in and day out, which of these things adds the most value or adds the most meaning to my life? Uh-huh. And do the same thing a second time and a third time. And, you know, those are the three tasks through which you accomplish the most. And there's usually a gaping chasm between these three tasks and all the other tasks in your work. Only a few things matter. And this is true whether you're a painter for a living, whether you're a podcaster for a living, whether you're an accountant for a living. There are just a very small amount of things that matter. For me, it's three things. It's, you know, cranking out that book that I finished last week, and then, you know, marketing it and seeing it through the finish line, through the design and everything. It's writing my website so I can chat with my readers and keep engaged with that side of my business. Mm-hmm. And it's doing speaking engagements. And those are the three things through which I accomplish more than any other task in my work. I accomplish more through those things than meetings, than through doing email, than through, you know, booking trips. That's why I have an assistant do those types of things, so I can focus on the things that actually matter. I think that's, you know, maybe I'll do one tactic from each, because I would say
so. That was incredibly useful. Let's go into the one on energy then. that was beautiful. So let's talk about energy, because that was one that's very interesting to me personally.
Energy is, I'll do three because they're relatively quick. I won't spend as long as on these three as that one. You know, energy is this weird thing. You know, you look at, okay, how does energy play in with productivity? And I think the answer is quite simple. You know, and energy is kind of the fuel that you burn to accomplish more over the course of the day, especially mental energy. You know, your brain takes up 2 to 3% of your body mass, but it burns off 20% of the calories you consume. You know, it's pound for pound the part of your body that takes up the most energy. And, you know, providing it with this constant fuel, you know, there's kind of the golden triangle of things that you can do to cultivate your energy levels. And I always feel like such like a mom talking about this stuff, but the three things are exercising. So moving more, eating better, and getting enough sleep. Yeah, maybe work our way backwards. Sleep is huge. I have this rule, and it's kind of pseudoscientific. There's no science whatsoever behind it, but I follow it religiously. And it's that for every hour of sleep I miss out on, I lose 2 hours of productivity the next day. Hmm. And I think if everybody followed that rule, you know, I think 40% of everybody in the United States doesn't get enough sleep. And that's a huge number. People are walking around like zombies, and sleep impacts every single aspect of your mental performance. In the research that I've encountered, I haven't really encountered any research that shows how sleep can be good for you. Maybe you know, reducing how much of a filter you have in your head, but on a very basic level, sleep is a way of exchanging your time for energy. And when energy is the fuel that you burn to be productive over the course of the day, and your brain needs so much of it, I think that's huge. Eating better, you know, what happens after you eat something is your body converts that food into glucose. So just as an oil refinery converts oil into gasoline, your body that a car can burn, your body converts food into glucose that your body burns off as energy. Glucose is gasoline for your body. And so when you eat things that are processed, you know, these foods that come pre-packaged and everything, they're basically pre-digested for you by machines. You know, there isn't much sustenance in them. And so your body burns through them like crazy. You get this crazy energy high because your brain is flooded with glucose, then you crash a bit later. And you feel that kind of drag at 1 or 2 in the afternoon after you ate the big meal or after you ate the Big Mac. You know, you feel kind of sluggish because your glucose is a roller coaster throughout the day. And so in terms of eating, I know I'm throwing a lot of stuff out there right now, mm-hmm. but in terms of eating, you know, slowing down when you eat, eating more mindfully, to actually not only taste what you're eating, but actually not have that roller coaster of energy, so your body knows when it's full so you can stop eating. You know, your body takes at least 15 minutes to tell your brain that it's full. And so you need to kind of build that bandwidth in when you eat. Not only that, but eating foods that are less processed, that aren't processed for machines for you. You know, whole foods, whole meats, like these things that take your body longer to burn. That's another huge thing. Mm. Exercise. Do you exercise?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah? Every day?
Yeah.
Good man. You know, our bodies, the reason why exercise has a huge mental impact is because we evolved, you know, our bodies are kind of stuck in time in a way. After the Stone Age, they haven't evolved much. They're stuck in, we evolved to walk 5 to 10 miles every single day, day in and day out. And what's happening now is we're getting pretty much no physical activity. And so the biggest impact that exercise has mentally is on stress. And, you know, just as we get almost no physical activity today when we used to get a ton, you know, we used to not have a lot of stress in our environment. You know, we used to come into contact with a saber-toothed tiger every once in a while for a couple minutes every odd day. But we didn't have this constant stress of, you know, being in a workplace environment, being surrounded by distractions and all that sort of stuff. And so the exercise is the best way to combat against that stress. It literally burns off the stress that you accumulate over the course of the day and over the course of the week and has these insane mental benefits. Whew, there we go. So sleep, eating better, and exercising.
Okay, cool.
Was that a lot? Was that a
was
lot to
plenty. And no, I didn't even want to stop you because there was so much gold there. So okay. Let's talk about attention. Cool.
This is what happens. I ramble. This, you know, this is why I can't be on podcasts, because I just like go. It was like a slow start. We kind of got into a groove, but now like I can't stop. Sorry.
No, this is great. Keep going. So let's talk about attention.
Cool. Yeah. People suck at managing their attention. You know, some people are great at it, but we're surrounded by millions of things, not only outside our heads, but also inside our heads. One of the best things that somebody can do to build up how much attention they bring to everything around them is to only work on one thing at one time. And so I think multitasking is, I don't think this, science thinks this. Multitasking is one of the biggest things that is holding people back from accomplishing more over the course of the day. Because it's like what I mentioned earlier. When we multitask, instead of investing 100% of our energy in one direction, we spread it across 100 different things at once, mm-hmm. one direction. Have you heard the song Night Changes, by the way?
I haven't, actually.
It's very good. You should download it after the podcast. but, you know, This is the problem, I think. You know, we spread our energy in so many different directions that we can't, we move a millimeter in a thousand different directions instead of moving a mile in one. Uh-huh. And multitasking, the interesting thing about the science behind multitasking is I used to multitask when I started my project and I wanted to conduct an experiment around only working on one thing at one time, but I kept putting it off. Because I loved multitasking. It's like being busy, right? You know how being busy stimulates your mind. Multitasking is the exact same way. It stimulates your mind, and it's more stimulating than only working on one thing at one time. So I resisted doing it. But when you look at the science behind it, you know, study after 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 study shows that multitasking makes you less productive, not more productive. Mm-hmm. It makes you more prone to errors. It decreases your memory. It actually takes longer. You know, you feel like it doesn't because you're more stimulated, but it takes longer to do everything because your mind can't focus on two things at one time. You know, you can walk and chew gum at the same time, but you can't focus on walking and chewing gum at the same time. You know, you can't focus on more than one thing at one time, and there are costs that come along with switching between things on the fly. And so working on one thing at one time, you know, it lets you not only dedicate 100% of your attention and energy and time to just one target, to just one thing, you know, it allows you to bring so much more of yourself to your work. And especially when you take that step back, you know, with how you manage your time to figure out what's meaningful, what makes an impact in your work, you know, it lets you kind of appreciate and enjoy it that much more. You know, I experienced this in my project. You know, I declined those jobs. I started the project exploring my passion for an entire year. And I was just moving faster and faster instead of working slower and more deliberately and with more intention. And because of that, I enjoyed it so much less than I should have enjoyed it because I was following my passion. Mm-hmm. And so it not only lets you work more efficiently. I hate the word efficiency because it reduces everything you do down to something that's kind of cold and corporate. But I don't think there's a better word here. You know, single tasking, just working on one thing at one time, lets you work more efficiently. It lets you dive deep into what you're doing. And so, yeah, single tasking, you know, people talk about working mindfully all the time. Single tasking is basically mindfulness. You know, working on one thing at one time is a way of carving out this attentional space around what you're working on in the moment so you can reflect on how you're feeling about what you're doing and how much energy you have and whether you got enough sleep and whether you need to change your habits around your energy too. You know, it creates more space around the task in the moment so you can work smarter and more efficiently.
Wow.
Meditation helps too, by the way.
Wow. There's just a lot of really, really good stuff here. You know, it's interesting.
So you got me going.
I didn't want to stop you because there's a lot there. but it makes me think about something that, you know, one of our former podcast guests, Jim Bunch, had said about designing environments for, you know, optimal performance and creativity. And one of the big questions that he threw at me was, what if you said no to everything that wasn't on track with your bigger purpose? And that always kind of stuck with me. And it's funny because you've taken that and really dissected it. You know, I realize, much like you, you know, I have a book to write and I have a list of goals and priorities on my desk. And I'm like, okay, everything that isn't on track with these these things that are written on this card that I went and got laminated is actually not essential or important right now.
Yeah, precisely.
And the thing is, you know, we say yes to a lot of things that are incredibly unimportant all day long.
Yeah. You know, we answer emails when we don't have to. Even when it comes to making decisions in the moment, we say yes to checking social media when you look at kind of the web of everything that you do over the course of the day. Not many people, maybe one or two have, but not many people change the world through social media. Mm-hmm. They change the world by writing books. They change the world by making their art, by investing their time into what they find meaningful. And that's the problem, right? Because when you look at how much resistance your brain puts up to certain tasks in your work relative to other tasks, your brain doesn't resist social media. but your brain resists writing a book. Right. And you know, the science behind that is fascinating. There's been a study out of Carleton University, my alma mater, where they looked at, okay, why do we procrastinate on certain tasks and not on other tasks? And it turns out that there are certain triggers that a task can have that make you more likely to procrastinate with it. And those are whether, and there's seven of them, those are whether a task is boring, frustrating, difficult, whether it's ambiguous or unstructured, and the final two, whether it lacks intrinsic reward, so it's rewarding in and of itself, or whether it lacks personal meaning. And the more of these triggers that a task has, the more likely you are to put off doing it. So you look at writing a book versus social media. You know, writing a book, the end result is so freaking cool because you can hold a book in your hands and say, I made this. I made, there was once not a book and now there is a book. And that's because I put words to a page and I made this. Mm-hmm. But to get from zero to one, you know, you have to slog your way through this task that's boring, that's frustrating, that's difficult. You know, it has a shitload of personal meaning, but it doesn't have much intrinsic rewards. And, you know, it's often ambiguous and unstructured. And so you put off doing it in favor of social media or watching Netflix, which, of course, aren't boring, frustrating, difficult, ambiguous. It's not Netflix is so structured that it presents you with the next episode of Orange is the New Black before you finish watching the current one. Right. That's how structured it is. That's why we put off doing the important things for the stuff that isn't important, because our brain doesn't have that resistance. It's like you've had Seth Godin on it a time or two, and he talks about this whole lizard brain idea. You know, you have this visceral emotional reaction to certain tasks in your work, whether you like it or not. And it's because they set, this is what the research shows, it's because they set off these triggers. And the way out of this, by the way, once you kind of step back from writing a book or working on a report or doing your art, whatever your art happens to be. The thing I love about Seth Godin's work is he broadens the definition of an artist to be so inclusive, regardless of what somebody does. And I love that. That's my favorite aspect of his work, you know, especially, you know, I talked about my story a little bit growing up, not having many friends when I moved over to Ontario, kind of looking inwards. That inclusiveness is something that I love whenever I come across it in other people's work. And so I love that definition of his art, but as a yet another tangent. But what happens when you notice yourself procrastinating on writing a book or doing a report or your art is you can take a step back from it and think like, okay, writing a book is boring and it's frustrating, for example. So maybe to make it less boring, you can reward yourself after you do it, or, you know, set time limits so you make it more fun for yourself and make a game out of it. Maybe to make it less frustrating, you can, you know, have a weekly call with somebody else who's happens to be writing a book and talk about the struggles that you're facing. Unstructured, you can define an outline ahead of time before you dive into writing the chapters. Ambiguous, you know, you can do some research around the process. You know, it probably has personal meaning, or intrinsic rewards to make it more rewarding. You know, you can have a word counter so you can see your progress throughout the course of the project. You know, these are all things. And this is, I think, the nugget behind why, you know, what it takes to get more done. You know, I talk about the deliberateness, the intention behind what you're doing. This is the case with everything, you know, whether in general, whether it's, you know, what you're working on in general or what you're working on every day. You know, if you find you're resisting something, taking that step back is huge. Whether, you know, you don't have to live in total isolation to do it, you know, to take a step back from whatever project you're resisting from your lizard brain and think about how you can reverse those triggers.
Wow. Well, Chris, this has been really, really cool.
Oh, cool, man.
And a lot of really tactical and practical insights, which I really appreciate. So I want to close with one final question. And since you've heard our interviews, you probably know what's coming. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
It actually took me a while to come up with this answer. So I'm happy I heard a couple interviews and that I don't have to come up with it extemporaneously. I think what makes someone unmistakable is when they accomplish exactly what they intend to. And when what they intend to accomplish comes from a place deep inside of them. So whether that's their passion, whether that's caring for other people, whether that's, you know, connecting whatever they do with that deep part of them to something they value, I think that's huge.
Awesome. Well, like I said, this has been really fantastic, and I really appreciate you taking the time to join us.
Like the interview.
I'm sure they will.
Okay, cool.
So, again, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Oh, can I be a douchebag and promote?
Oh yeah, stuff? Absolutely.
just my website, alifeofproductivity.com. There's no ads, there's no sponsorships on it whatsoever. That's kind of a rule that I set for myself since starting the project, you know, kind of put stuff out there for people to enjoy, for people to benefit from, because, you know, that's my work. That's what I'm proud of. And that's where people can find what I do there is one of those annoying newsletter pop-ups that comes up. But you can like X that and never see it again. That's my website if people want to check it out.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that. If you like what you heard, the greatest compliment you could give us is to share the show with a friend and let people know what you think by leaving a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening to The Unmistakable Creative.